Matter of State versus Rashawn Bell. May we please have appearances of counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Erin Campbell, Assistant Hudson County Prosecutor on behalf of the state.
Stephen A. Yomtov, Deputy Attorney General for Amicus, Attorney General of New Jersey.
Susan L. Romeo, Assistant Deputy Public Defender on behalf of Mr. Bell.
Zachary Levy from Pashman Stein Walter Hayden on behalf of Amicus Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good afternoon, counsel. Welcome. Ms. Campbell, please go ahead. Ms. Campbell, I can't hear you. Am I alone?
I apologize, Judge. I was muted. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal at the end of arguments if necessary.
That's fine.
We are here today on two issues. First, does charging multiple counts of leaving the scene of a fatal accident violate the rule against multiplicity? And second, and no less important, did the appellate division err in resentencing this defendant to an aggregate term of 5 years rather than remanding to the trial court for a reconsideration of the plea as it stood following their ruling? This defendant pled guilty to two counts of leaving the scene of a fatal accident. Pursuant to the plea agreement, his exposure was capped at 5 years each. Due to the sentencing language in the statute, all parties, the state, the court, and the defendant, understood that they would be sentenced consecutively and that therefore the defendant would receive an aggregate term of 10 years. This defendant had an extensive criminal history and was subject to a discretionary extended term on second degree charges. Two parties were aggrieved by the appellate division's ruling. First, the state, whose reasonable expectations under the plea agreement were violated, and second, the trial court, who accepted an aggregate term of 10 years as within the interest of justice. This is contrary to Rule 3:9-3. A plea requires a meeting of the minds between the state and the defendant, and a court has the authority to reject a plea if it concludes that the prosecutor has abused his discretion in reaching the agreement. If following the plea, the court does not believe that the interest of justice will be served by effectuating it, the court has the authority to vacate the plea. The appellate division's decision here deprived the trial court of the opportunity to accept or reject that plea agreement following their ruling, and in fact acted as a court of original jurisdiction in determining that a 5-year sentence was acceptable and appropriate under these circumstances. The appellate division's ruling here violated the language of State v. Rodriguez, which unambiguously disapproves of a, quote, penal result that would be fortuitous and wholly unrelated to the legitimate factors the courts are adjured to follow in dispensing appropriate criminal punishment. A defendant should reasonably accept that if a sentence which is to be served consecutively to other sentences imposed for the same criminal episode is found to be legally deficient, the trial court may reconsider other parts of the overall sentence to assure that the defendant receives a proper punishment. Instead of remanding the trial court to consider the plea and sentence, the appellate division imposed sentence on its own. This court recently in State v. Torres placed great value on the explanation, of the overall fairness of a sentence imposed, and it required sentencing courts to contextualize the individual sentence's length, deterrent value, and incapacitation purpose and need when imposing consecutive sentences. It was clear from the dismissal motion at the trial level that the court accepted the state's position that these two counts were to be served consecutively to one another, and therefore considered that sentence in the aggregate in determining that the plea agreement reached served the interest of justice. Not only did the appellate division fail to address any of these considerations, but they hamstrung the trial court by simply remanding for the entry of a corrected JOC. Allowing the defendant to resentence the defendant to the minimum allowable term does nothing to foster consistency and uniformity in sentencing, and their failure to explain the overall fairness of the sentence means that there is no record for review. That's contrary to this court's holding in Torres. This matter should have been remanded for any number of reasons. First, for the state to move to vacate the sentence, as there was no meeting of the minds and its reasonable expectations under the plea were violated, or for the trial court to vacate the sentence as not within the interest of justice pursuant to Rule 3:9-3. The state would respectfully request that this court remind the appellate division of its holdings in Rodriguez and its progeny should this issue arise in the future. The appellate division further incorrectly ruled that this defendant could not be charged with two counts of leaving the scene of a fatal accident, and further failed to harmonize the various leaving the scene statutes. Several portions of the leaving the scene statute can and should be read to permit multiple charges. First, the reference to the duties in NJSA 39:4-129, which imposes a duty on a driver knowingly involved in an accident to identify himself and render reasonable aid to a person injured in the accident. The duty is not just to report, but to help. A driver who has only rendered aid to one of the two victims, therefore, has not fulfilled his duties under the statute. This means that the defendant was required to render reasonable assistance or summon aid for both Alexander and Eleonel, either by reporting the accident to police or by taking them to receive aid himself. Furthermore, the end of that first paragraph of the leaving the scene statute references another person, and the final paragraph references the driver's knowledge or awareness of the death. Both of those words are in the singular. The legislature chose to say another and not any. When charging leaving the scene of a fatal accident, the state should not have to choose which victim gets justice. The legislature could have chosen to say any person, and it could have referred to the defendant's awareness of, quote, death or deaths. The history of this statute further supports escalating punishment. In 1997, this statute was enacted as a third-degree crime with a mandatory one-year period of parole ineligibility. In 2003, the presumption of non-incarceration for first-time offenders was removed. And in 2007, pursuant to Michelle's law, this statute was elevated to a second-degree offense. Michelle was a victim in Union County who was struck crossing the street and lived for several hours after the accident. Had that driver stopped and summoned aid as he was required to, she may have lived. There are two bills pending before our legislature right now, one that seeks to elevate this crime to a first-degree offense, and a second called Marissa's Law, which seeks to impose a mandatory period of parole ineligibility similar to Graves and Brimage. Marissa Procopio was a Monmouth County teenager who was left to die on Route 36. She was airlifted to a nearby hospital and passed the next day. At a time when our government and the statutes enacted are focused on rehabilitation, the fact that this particular statute chooses to focus on punishment is significant. The legislative history of the statute clearly seeks to remove any incentive to flee the scene, and a driving force behind that removing that incentive is to encourage people to stop and help these victims instead of leaving them to die in the street. Reviewing the legislative history behind this statute shows that the legislature is slowly equalizing leaving the scene of a fatal accident with other homicide offenses, and allowing only one charge frustrates that purpose because it's still... Yes,
Ms. Campbell, we're interpreting the particular language, of course, of Section 5.1 as it currently exists. Using ordinary common language, if a driver strikes another car that has two passengers in it, how many accidents have there been?
There's only one accident, Your Honor. However, the appellate...
And if that driver...
Then walks or drives away from the scene...
How many times has the person left the scene?
He's only left once, Your Honor, but that's not the entirety of the statute. He also has a duty to each person he hits.
I'm going to allow you to expand your answer. I just want to come to the core of my question here, and that is, focus on the statute's wording itself. What is the operative conduct that it addresses? What is the, not the result, but what is the operative behavior by an actor that it condemns?
It's leaving the scene without fully performing his duties to the passengers in the other vehicle. It's not just about leaving the scene, Judge. It's about leaving the scene without fully performing his duties under the Title 39 statute, which include summoning aid, or if aid would be futile, summoning assistance from the police. A person who's fulfilled those duties under the statute and then leaves has maybe technically left the scene of an accident, but he hasn't violated the statute because he's fulfilled his duties under 39:4-129.
Following up on the Chief Justice's question, you're right. There are certain duties attached. So if there were two victims and you only come to the aid of one, you violated the statute. But it doesn't mean that you've violated the statute twice. It just means you violated it once. You haven't fulfilled all of the duties under the statute. You can't leave the scene. Leaving the scene requires that you do something. If you don't fulfill the other imperatives of the statute, you violated the statute. It doesn't mean that you've violated the statute multiple times. Isn't that a reasonable interpretation of the statute? At least one reasonable interpretation of the statute.
It is a potentially reasonable interpretation of the statute, Your Honor, but it's the state's position.
Which leads to the next question. If there are two reasonable, let's assume that your interpretation is reasonable and the one that has been proposed by the Chief Justice or suggested in his questioning is reasonable. And therefore, the statute is insolubly ambiguous, then we're in the rule of lenity. And therefore, we would have to interpret this statute in a way that was favorable to the defendant. Am I correct? Go ahead.
I'd submit that the singular language in the statute indicates a purposeful intent on the part of the legislature to permit multiple leaving the scene charges for each person to whom the defendant owes a duty. That each victim in this case was owed a duty under this motor vehicle statute, and each person was therefore victimized by defendant's conduct in his failure to perform that duty.
So you've advanced an interpretation. Justice Albin asked you if there are competing interpretations, and the emphasis is given on the verb leave the scene.
Where does that
leave us in terms of canons of statutory interpretation, and assume that the legislative history doesn't clear up the question for us? There may be little pieces here and there, but it doesn't answer the precise question. Doesn't the doctrine of lenity then apply?
Judge, I would go back to my initial interpretation of the statute. It's not just about leaving the scene. It's about leaving the scene and violating your duty to each person involved in that accident. And each person is their own victim under the statute because the language in the statute is plainly singular.
So your view is there's no ambiguity in the statute when it criminalizes leaving the scene with attendant results and duties. That permits multiple charges for the same accident and the same single departure.
Yes, Judge, leaving the scene is only part of it. It's leaving the scene while failing to fulfill your duties to each person involved in that accident. And Your Honor, that interpretation is supported by the Appellate Division's recent decision in State v. Herrera. Herrera was admittedly a single victim case that involved merger of the leaving the scene of involving serious bodily injury and the endangering an injured victim. But Herrera tells us that the statute uses the threat of criminal sanction to deter absconding from the scene of an injury and to encourage persons to take affirmative steps to protect injured individuals. The culpable act, as described by Herrera, is not just leaving the scene, but leaving the scene without stopping to render aid or call for emergency medical assistance.
With respect to the language in the statute that specifically states that if the evidence so warrants, nothing in this section shall be deemed to preclude an indictment and conviction for aggravated manslaughter, reckless vehicular homicide, and strict liability vehicular homicide. Does that not focus on the occupants of the vehicle as opposed to the accident itself? That leaves the state with other ways to punish and address the injuries or the deaths caused in the accident. In this case, my understanding is that the driver was determined the driver was going twice the speed limit at the time that they struck these two boys on a bicycle. That would apply one of these, that would be sufficient evidence to or in one of these indictments, wouldn't that be the case?
Well, Judge, part of the issue with the leaving the scene of a fatal accident statute is that when a defendant like Mr. Bell leaves the scene, he deprives the state of the opportunity to investigate. I mentioned Marissa Procopio, the Monmouth County teenager who was struck. The woman who struck her showed up at the police station hours later. She had alcohol, and cocaine in her system. She told the police she had gotten high and drunk in the interim, and because of her blood alcohol and cocaine levels, they were unable to prove aggravated manslaughter. By going home and later going to the police, she deprived the police of that opportunity to investigate. So yes, there are situations where an individual leaves the scene and the police are able to piece it back together and perhaps put together a case based on causation under those statutes. But when a defendant leaves the scene and deprives the police completely of the opportunity to investigate, say if he goes home and sobers up and turns himself in 3 days later, we've lost an aggravated manslaughter charge and we can't prove that. Allowing two charges of leaving the scene would appropriately punish a defendant for what he's done.
Well, you know, leaving the scene as a second degree crime is no minor thing. That's a 5 to 10 year prison sentence for leaving the scene. That's a very serious crime, even if it applies once. And if, as Judge Fuentes has suggested, because you have speed over here, you could have two cases of reckless manslaughter in addition, which would be consecutive under the statute, correct?
Yes, Judge. However, if this defendant is looking at, say, two counts of aggravated manslaughter versus one count of leaving the scene that's a flat number instead, it's a no-brainer. He's going to flee. Allowing two counts of leaving the scene further removes that incentive.
All that said, we need to focus on the language of the statute and try to figure out what it says. Would you agree?
Yes, Judge.
And you've come forward with a presentation about how it can be read to allow for multiple charges for a single accident and a single leaving of the scene. And your adversaries have come forward with a strong presentation about how it only applies to one. Where does that leave us in terms of the appropriate analysis of a statute?
Your Honor, many other states have interpreted their leaving the scene statutes, and the dividing line for them was the use of the word any versus the word another. And I would submit that the legislature's purposeful choice of saying the death of another person and death singular at the end of the statute means that it refers to one death. Each charge refers to one death.
What I'm hearing you say is that there is no alternative reading other than the one that you're putting forward. Is that your position, that there is no ambiguity? And the
one way to read the statute is that it permits multiple prosecutions for the act, the single departure from the scene. Have I heard you correctly?
Yes, Your Honor. Multi-victim accidents are not so uncommon that it's unforeseeable that the legislature would consider them in drafting the statute.
I'm asking a slightly different question. Is it your position that there is no reasonable alternative interpretation to this statute, and thus no ambiguity? Your position is the one and only correct reading of it.
Yes, Judge. I don't believe the statute is ambiguous because it refers back to that Title 39 offense that imposes a duty on each person that's injured. And the singular language in the statute means that the legislature intended that statute to apply to each victim separately.
Please go ahead with your argument.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. The appellate division improperly relied on State versus Hill White. Hill White is an arson case, and arson is plainly a property crime. It's complete when the fire is started, and the purpose of the statute is to protect the property of another. The purpose here, as stated by the appellate division recently in Herrera, is to protect an injured victim. There's a causation element in the arson statute that's not present here, and the grading of the arson statute is not based upon the harm to the victim, but on the mental state of the defendant. You can commit an aggravated arson without any harm to a victim. I had mentioned the other states that use the word any rather than another, and several states have found that the verbiage used in the statute should drive the result of the interpretation. For example, in Dake versus State, 675 Southern 2D 1365, a 1995 Alabama appellate case, the court asked, how then should the unit of prosecution be described so that an intent to allow multiple convictions is clear and unequivocal? Instead of using the word any to describe the unit of prosecution, the singular words a or another should be used. And in State v. Powell, a Wisconsin case, Powell was charged not just for leaving the scene, but for failing to comply with his statutory responsibilities to each victim. And the Wisconsin court reasoned the state would have to prove both failures to get a conviction under that statute. The court opined that given the statute pertains to a vehicle operator's duties to certain individuals at an accident scene, it makes sense to allow punishment for violations of duties to separate individuals. Your Honor, the state would respectfully request that the court adopt its interpretation of the leaving the scene statute and reverse the judgment of the appellate division. If the court has no remaining questions, I submit.
Would you like to address the second argument that you began with at the opening?
The sentencing, Your Honor?
Yes. The plea agreement and the state's position and its expectation. As an alternative argument, I understand that your principal position is your reading of the statute should prevail and there should be two counts, but if the court doesn't accept that, would you like to address the plea agreement issue?
Your Honor, this defendant pled guilty to two counts of leaving the scene, and it was everyone's understanding that it would be sentenced consecutively. When the state entered into that plea agreement, it only did so because it believed that this defendant was getting an aggregate sentence of 10 years. The appellate division have that sentence and remanded it to the trial court for an entry of a new JOC. It should have been remanded to the trial court for the state to, one, reconsider whether it thought that 5 years was an appropriate plea offer, given that there were two children killed in this accident and that the defendant had an extensive criminal history, that the defendant had no license to drive, and that the defendant was driving an unregistered, uninsured car with fictitious plates.
Can I ask you a question about reasonable expectations? Why didn't this was a plea agreement? And in the plea agreement, the defendant, with the permission of the prosecution, reserved the right to challenge the interpretation of the statute, correct?
Correct.
You knew that the defendant was going to argue that sentencing on two was unlawful, correct? Why didn't the state, therefore, in the plea agreement say, in the event that you are successful, this case will be remanded for a resentence? Like, why didn't the state do that?
Because, Your Honor, the entire body of case law says that when the defendant has a windfall, essentially, in the appellate division and receives a lower sentence based on legal principles that are wholly unrelated to the sentencing and to the legitimate sentencing factors enumerated in the statute, the state's entitled to either move to vacate the plea or the defendant should expect to be resentenced to the top of the aggregate range. The state can't go beyond that 10 years, but the state would be entitled to move to resentence him or renegotiate the plea.
Your argument, in essence, is you bargained for a 10-year sentence in the aggregate, mm-hmm. and that if there's a legal error, it should go back and the parties should start anew with their conversation.
Yes, no? Your Honor. Or the trial court, or the alternative that the trial court should have been permitted to weigh in and explore whether or not it would have been even willing to accept that 5-year plea given the facts and circumstances of this case.
Anything else you'd like to present?
No, Your Honor.